Hello?
Hi, I'm with Inconclusive Research. We are conducting a poll in your area about the presidential campaign. May I ask you a few questions?
Sure. I'm voting for Trump. He's the best. End of story.
Whoa, big fella. That's what we call premature tabulation in the polling sciences. We have to go through the dependent variables to get a bivariate analysis so we can generate a trust coefficient.
Okay, go ahead.
Assign a hypothetical numerical value to the importance you place on your ability to control the bad things in your day, and then another numerical value of the number of times per week when you make toast, and then divide the sum by the percentage of the time you feel bored. Now, think of a fish. Was the number 7?
What number?
You see, polling is a science. It's a lot more complicated than just blurting out a candidate preference.
Ask me a different question.
I'm going to ask you to use a feeling thermometer to gauge your feelings about certain candidates, with 100 being warm and positive and 0 being cold and distant. How would you rate a candidate who broke up with his high school sweetheart by giving her a mix CD with a cover that said, "I Can't Go On" in green Comic Sans?
Wait a minute. I did that.
I still think about you, David.
Is this you, Alexa? Is this really a poll?
Yes, and I'm marking you down as 100% for Sanders.
Yeah, but I'm Trump.
Why don't you tell that to the girl you dumped me for? Huh? Leslie from the Church of Nazarene with the big breasts and the D-plus average?
She got run over by a meat truck last week.
Look at your phone, David.
Oh my God, you're calling from inside the house.
From Nate Silver, the master of suspense who brought you Poll Sweet Poll, now comes Sample Error.
How does it feel to be an outlier, David?
And now, a much less thrilling radio show. Here's the man who still claims to be voting for Dewey, Colin McEnroe.
I said it then, I'll say it now if anybody asks me. All right, I don't know that this will be a less thrilling radio show. This could be thrilling in its own way. We are going to be talking about polling, something that you talk about all the time, more than you think you do, probably. And so joining us to talk about what polling really is and some of the transitions that polling is going through in the thick of this campaign season, Jennifer Dineen returns to us, program director for the graduate program in survey research at the UConn Department of Public Policy. Joining us by phone is Ann Seltzer, about as big a polling celebrity in Iowa as anybody. She's like a national celebrity as a result of being a polling celebrity in Iowa. She's president of Seltzer and Company and the official, it says the official Iowa polling queen. I wouldn't want to dispute that.
Wearing a tiara.
All right, for the Des Moines Register and Bloomberg Politics. And a little bit later, we'll be talking to David Folkenflik. He's the media correspondent for NPR News. If there are problems with polls, I sort of believe we in the media create a lot of them. So, and maybe just to begin on that point, so I was saying to Jennifer before we went on the air, this morning I was listening to Morning Edition. They had that usual Cokie Roberts political analysis segment. She was talking to Robert Costa from The Washington Post. And because my ears were tuned for this, I was just noticing all the times that they made reference to polls, what the Wisconsin polls say, what polls say about Donald Trump and women, what general election polls say, and whether general election polls are meaningful when candidates have not yet run head-to-head, on and on. I'd be willing to guess that most of the polls that they were talking about were not polls they personally have read. They've probably read articles about the polls or summaries of the polls, because that's what a lot of us in journalism do. So I'm going to ask both of you, but I'll start with you, Jennifer Dineen. Is that a mistake? I mean, polls tend to have a lot of the devil and God are in the details in polls a lot of the time. You might say that, you know, Donald Trump has a 77% problem with women in polls or something, but that sounds a little glib and compacted, and it's probably a little bit more richly nuanced story than that.
Well, it certainly is a richly nuanced story, but you're not, I don't think, misperceiving what you're hearing. We've become increasingly a data-driven society. Mm. We look for polls and information and on all sorts of topics, particularly with elections. And what makes elections unique, I think, is that we used to get our information sort of from the ground, and everybody had an agenda to push or a candidate to push or a policy to push. We looked to polls as that independent source of information. But the amount of polling that's happened, you know, between 1984 and 2000, those elections, the number of election-focused polls increased, they estimate, by 900% approximately. So you're hearing more of it because there's more of it.
And Seltzer, there's more of it. But once again, I mean, I think as Jennifer says, we live in kind of a data-driven society. So we see it all crunched up on Real Clear Politics as an average, or Nate Silver doing his magic with it. I would assume for those of you who actually do this for a living, you do see a poll as a little bit more of a breathing thing. I know if I'm covering a race very seriously and closely, and I'm one of the smaller number of journalists covering the race, like a gubernatorial race in Connecticut, I certainly read all the cross tabs and the polls. I mean, there's all kinds of little nuggets and stuff. It's really not just that final number that burps out at the end of the pipe.
Well, I think you have to think about how many polls there are, and as there's a downside to that, which is there's a lot of information out there, and how do you sort it out? It puts a lot of burden on the listeners or the readers and even on pollsters to figure out, well, is this a good poll or not? But on the other side, imagine what you would know about this contest if you didn't have poll numbers. Mm-hmm. Because we're seeing such an unusual rolling out of this presidential campaign that anybody who didn't have a poll to tell you what actually voters are thinking about would not likely guess in this particular case.
Although a lot of what I'm reading these days, Jennifer, is stuff about ways in which polls are finding this particular election challenging to cover, polls or pollsters finding it challenging, and that's in a larger context of challenges, new challenges to polling, which we'll talk about here in this segment. But it seems as though, especially here, whether it's Bernie Sanders in Michigan, where he's just like wildly outperformed, not just one poll or two polls, but all the polls, or just the difficulty in anticipating the rise of Donald Trump. And you've got Nate Silver time and again saying, well, he's going to hit a wall here. No, oh, he's going to max out here. No, this is the ceiling, right? It's over here. You can't go beyond this. And he keeps busting through. So this has been specifically a hard election to cover, right?
This has been an incredibly hard election to cover. To be fair to Nate, I think almost all of us said he's going to hit a wall here. He'll be out by St. Patrick's Day, right? Over and over, this is sort of defying much logic. But I think one of the things that we have to remember is that this is primary polling. And so voters tend to have low information. Mm-hmm. They tend to decide later. Estimates are closer to the actual election. And people haven't quite gotten there yet at the same rate as the pollsters and the aggregators and the media. I mean, horse race polling for this election started in February of 2013. We expect a lot if we're expecting voters to know then what they're going to do. And there are factors in this campaign that make it particularly challenging. The personality, the number of candidates, all sorts of things.
So, and Ann Seltzer, that's piled on top of a bigger problem. There's some bigger problems that affect polls, and they probably affect these kinds of polls even more, and that's the degree to which a person who is a potential respondent to a poll regards it as some kind of civic duty to participate in the poll and ask questions. I mean, that gradient has just gone down and down and down, and I would imagine with this somewhat more casual relationship to the race that Jennifer just described, it's even more difficult to get somebody to participate in a primary poll.
Well, you know, and that varies from state to state. So we have pretty good response rates here in Iowa. We're the first state. We are likely the most polled state because of that, and we're still able to do a reasonably good job. But it's something that pollsters worry about, which is that people who, in a relatively small part of the population, who participate in caucuses, and that's true in other states around the country as well, that your phone is ringing off the hook with people who want to know what it is that you're going to be doing in the upcoming caucus or primary election. At some point, there's respondent wear out, and that's just one of many of the particular challenges that are facing us this time around. I would mention that with Michigan, the reason that those polls were so far off is that they made some assumptions based on the 2008 primary in that state. And if you recall, Michigan was one of the states that jumped ahead of the pack. They jumped ahead in terms of their proper place, and so they were sanctioned. They were going to lose delegates, and several of the Democratic candidates signed a pledge in Iowa saying, we will not campaign in any state that jumps ahead. So on the Michigan ballot, you had Hillary Clinton, who refused to sign that pledge, And then the second place winner was uncommitted.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama's name did not appear on that ballot. So anybody going back to that election to say, here's what primaries look like in Michigan, they were just wrongheaded from the get-go.
So, Jennifer, let's get to one of the things that most people's perception of this problem is accurate, but their information about how polling has dealt with it is maybe a little bit out of date. I've already gotten at least one tweet about it at WNPR Colin here today, and that is that that cell phones are not in the mix the way they're supposed to be. That certainly was a challenge early on, but most of the polls that I read now do, in fact, seem to incorporate cell phones in a pretty sizable way.
Absolutely. I think most of the polls, certainly most of the polls who are reputable and want to get it right, have incorporated cell phones. And even some of the pollsters using alternate methodologies like the interactive voice response, some of them have started to include cell phone supplements because you can't call cell phones with a robocall. So I think that most pollsters have taken cell phone only numbers and households into their mix and their models. But I think your point gets to a point Anne made. Anne's very good because of the methods that she uses. And so as we have the demand for more news in a 24-hour news cycle and internet speed news, we have people doing polls, not doing all of the things like cell phone supplements and callbacks and things that take time and add expense to your research.
Right. And Seltzer, this has gotten harder. It's gotten more complicated. My recollection was that in 2015, there was another FCC ruling that was going to make it even harder in some ways on landlines. Did it have to do with call blocking or something like that?
Well, we're still trying to figure out exactly what it means, but there certainly are a lot of restrictions on what pollsters are allowed and not allowed to do in contacting cell phones. So in a way, cell phones have helped us better connect with younger people. But there are other things that have come along that have made some things even more complicated than they already were.
And, you know, Jennifer, I think it also may have to do with the mental state of the average person these days. The average person now watching television at home, when the phone rings, when the landline rings, a lot of us have a thing that we're up on the TV screen. It tells us what the number
right.
is. And so you have this whole choice that you can make right at that moment. Are you going to pause? What are you going to do? And so right away, the phone is competing with the thing that you're watching on television in a much more direct way than it used to be. I'm thinking that probably doesn't drive compliance. It doesn't make you want to pick up that number you don't recognize.
Sure. It's absolutely easier to not answer the phone than it is to hang up on someone once you've connected with them, right? So we've lost that. And I think that culturally, too, we've all become busier. I think the idea of everybody being home at dinner time, which is there's always jokes about pollsters calling at dinner time, it's true less often than it used to be 20, 30 years ago. Kids are busier. People are busier. They work later. And so I think they're not home all the time. But you're right. It's much easier to opt out before you have to talk to somebody.
You know, Ann Seltzer, in this particular political season and in this polling season, it does seem as though, I mean, kind of in an amusing way, the two candidates whose constituencies tend to skew a little bit paranoid, tend to sort of think, well, the deck is stacked against us. Things are not fair. You know, everything's wrong with this. We're not going to get a fair shake. That would be the Trump group and the Sanders group are also the people who sort of point to the polls and say, well, we underperform in the polls. We outperform our numbers in the polls. And I'm wondering if there's some connection there. I mean, maybe just in the sense that, you know, not everybody's equally cooperative. I mean, people in Iowa are probably a little bit more civic-minded and cooperative than people in other states that shall remain nameless. And maybe, you know, the Trump faction has a kind of cussedness, you know, a contrariness, which makes them a little less likely to cooperate with somebody who polls them or tries to poll them than, say, a Kasich voter.
Well, you know, I want to be sure that polls are getting their due here, which
sure.
is they've been pretty good.
Yeah.
So if we were having a massive problem with people not wishing to stop or pause their television viewing to answer the phone, and if that were skewing in a particular way, it would be impossible for anybody to be accurate, and that's not what we're seeing. I think the trick on the side of new voters coming in, which is what Bernie Sanders is certainly attracting, as well as some Donald Trump, anecdotally anyway, is can you get them included in your poll? Because if you're using lists of registered voters and you can show up on election day and register to vote that day, or if you're deciding that you're only interested in the Republican side, so you're not calling Democrats, but in the particular state you're polling, if you can show up as a Democrat, change your party registration that day. So there's some of that late decision to pay attention or even to decide who you're going to vote for that is always hard for pollsters. And I think we see in polls, there's in the exit polls and entrance polls, which are really helpful to say, well, what in fact happened here, that there's a lot of late deciding. And at some point, you know, the point of a poll is to tell a story. So at some point you have to stop polling and tell the story, and yet campaigning continues to happen. So there's some things that are happening way late that pollsters have a hard time catching.
I think you just said something almost that was word for word what Jennifer Dineen said the last time she sat in the studio a couple of years ago. But go ahead. What were you going to say, Jen?
Well, thanks for validating me, Ann. What I was going to say, too, is candidates always have a lot to say about the polls. I think the last time I sat here, we had a conversation because we were skewing. People were saying in 12 that polls were skewing Democrats, right? Mm-hmm. And Trump, in particular, has been infamous for discounting a particular poll in favor of another poll, mm-hmm. where he was performing better. I mean, one of the things that makes election polling challenging and primary polling incredibly challenging is that we don't know what the electorate's going to be like, mm-hmm. right? So typically we have a population and we know what that population should look like demographically, and we can compare our sample to that population. That's hard to do in an election poll, and especially in a primary poll, because we don't know what this particular electorate looks like yet. So candidates think they know. Mm-hmm. Pundits think they know. You know,
and some pollsters think they know.
That's true, too. And some pollsters don't listen to the data quite so much.
Right. And so I think that's one of the ways in which some things go wrong is people keep asking me, well, what do we have historically that would compare to this that we could take a look at? And I go, well, there isn't anything historically that compares to this. And yet there are a lot of polling firms that are, in fact, going back and looking at history to say, well, this is generally the way the population shakes out for a primary. And they're always volatile anyway, this year especially volatile.
And so I just want to stay with that for a second, Ann Salzer. I mean, you have a reputation as a little bit of a maverick about this, right? I mean, there's sort of ways in which a lot of people either tweak or weight poll results, which, as I understand it, you're not willing to do.
Well, I've not been called a maverick before, so. So I guess I will claim it. To me, you know, I do my best to be as science-driven as possible. So to start by saying, well, let's assume that the electorate is going to look like this. Now, to me, you're starting with a guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think when people are speculating about how the race is going to go and all of that, there's sometimes a bit of a wish in there. And sometimes that's a little bit biasing. And even if there's not a wish, the idea that this particular election, the way this is rolling out, would look like anything we've seen in the past. Certainly for the 2012 election, there were a lot of models, and Gallup is, I guess, the most notorious, whose their model for a likely voter was based on, it was data-driven, but it was based on the assumption that you have to be engaged with the campaign, you have to know where your polling place is, you have to have voted before, you have to, you know, say you're very interested in following the race. All of these things have been good predictors in the past, but there's so much more money that campaigns have available that for the Obama campaign in particular, as soon as they identified that you were a likely Obama voter, they were on you. They were getting an absentee ballot in your hands. They were, you know, coming by and picking it up and taking it. They were coming by and picking you up, taking you to the polls if you waited that long. It didn't matter how closely you were following the race. All of those social science predictors fall away when there's enough money to overcome barriers to getting people to vote.
And just so we're clear about this, because maybe the audience doesn't entirely understand what we're talking about, and very possibly I don't either. So when we talk about anticipating what the electorate's going to look like, and what we're saying is some pollsters think they know that, I'll do something really simplistic. I'm sure it's much more nuanced and subtle, but that, you know, 60% of the people who vote in this particular primary are going to be women based on everything that they've ever seen in the past. And so if the sample that they've got isn't exactly like that, they reweight the sample to reflect the fact that the sample looks a little bit different from how they think the actual turnout is going to be.
Exactly.
All right.
It does get into algebra, but they make their respondent pool look like what they think the electorate will look like.
So, Jennifer Dineen, one thing that was starting the last time we talked, but it's turned into this huge deal, is, in fact, aggregators or whatever we want to call them. And 538 and Nate Silver obviously are sort of the gold standard. At least he was the gold standard in the last election cycle, where he got everything right. He just absolutely ran the table using this averaging. I mean, not just a blunt kind of averaging, but once again, a somewhat subtle and nuanced averaging of polls. He just ran the table. He got everything right about the electoral map, and then he got all the Senate races right, and he knew what you were going to have for dinner and what your next Amazon purchase was going to be and stuff like that. So, and although it seems a little harder this year, maybe you can just talk about what is the role of maybe even just the rise of things like this in real clear politics? Does it change the polling picture?
I think it changes a little bit how we consume the polling picture. And you're right. I mean, Nate is probably the most famous of the aggregators. Real Clear Politics is the one who started this whole trend, or made a big public push with it. To again give polls their due, the aggregators aren't right if the polls are all that off, right? Because they're right. Using the polling data. Some of them are including other factors into it, so things like the economy and some externals to the election that people say are important. I think, you know, there are, like everything else, strengths and weaknesses. So the aggregators give people a way to look at a good amount of data altogether, not necessarily selecting polls that align with their own beliefs. You can kind of, distribute some of the error across. So if you have a couple of outliers, they can be taken into consideration. But they also do things like they combine unlike samples, like likely voters and registered voters, and they combine polls of different methodologies. And there's things that happen when you combine apples and bananas that don't happen when you combine apples and apples. And so I think, like I said, they're a good information shortcut, and they've changed the way we interact with polling, but not necessarily all for the better.
So, Ann Seltzer, for you, someone who takes some justifiable pride in what you do and how you do it and what your brand name is, what's it like to be mixed in as an ingredient? I mean, suddenly you're part of somebody else's cake.
Well, and as I often say, you can throw a lot of ingredients in a bowl, but it doesn't mean you're going to end up with a cake. Mm. You know, my frustration, and I've mellowed over time, but when this first started happening, and then they would show the individual dots on the graph that represent individual polls, and then they would show the average line, and presented it as though, well, that's what's true. If you just take all the data that are out there and you average them together, then you can see really what's true. And actually, if you go back to both 2012 and 2014, the aggregated data seems to be more conservative. It seems to be closer to a close race than what the outcomes turn out to be. And the pressure that puts on pollsters is just that. And my poll is an example, so we'll just use that. In 2014, we had now Senator Joni Ernst winning in our final poll by 7 percentage points. Well, the aggregated number was closer to 2 or 3 percentage points, so you had nationally prominent news personnel saying, well, let's just put this poll aside, because that's clearly an outlier. That doesn't really mesh with what we think is going to happen in this race. And in fact, what happened in the race was that Joni Ernst won not by 7 points, as our poll said, but by 8. That the conservative way of going didn't turn out to be true, and that happened in every swing, almost virtually every swing state with those Senate races, and happened the same thing in 2012. So there is pressure for conformity to a closer race because of what people are seeing on those polling aggregation sites. So in some ways, they do a disservice.
Yes. Speaking of disservices, what we're going to do is take a break. Not that that's a disservice, but I want to talk a little bit more about the press and the role that we play in all this, which I think sometimes is at least mildly a disservice. And so we're going to add to the conversation David Folkenflik, who's the watchdog for NPR over those disservices that we in the press commit. He'll be with us as well as Ann Seltzer and Jennifer Dineen after this.
Go to the polls, go to the polls and vote.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that Wisdom House thing and a chance to talk to Barry Blitt, he of the incendiary and fascinating New Yorker covers. But it'll be a great event in general. While we're talking about events, let me quickly remind you, I'll take 2 seconds just to do this, that on Wednesday night, I'll be over at Watkinson School with a terrific panel. We're going to talk about the public funding of sports, whether we're talking about the Yard Goats and the new franchise here in Hartford, or the attempt in 98 to bring the Patriots here, or the rise and fall of the Whalers, the most bemoaned logo-shaped hole in the hearts of its fans ever. We're going to talk all about that, sort of what it does, whether it's warranted, how the numbers work. We have an economist coming down from Holy Cross who studies this, also the president of the Yard Goats, Josh Solomon, and Oz Griebel, the leader of Metro Hartford Alliance. Also, there'll be members of the Whalers Nation there in the audience. If you want to come, please go to Watkinson.org. Look for the little freshly squeezed logo on the right-hand side. And we'd love to have you there. There's even a lovely dinner beforehand that you can register for. But you got to do that on the Watkinson.org website. It's Wednesday night. The forum starts at 7, a little dinner beforehand. All right. So I was wrong about Ann Seltzer. She has to go. So with us is Jennifer Dineen. She's here in studio with me. She is the program director of the graduate program in survey research at UConn's Department of Public Policy. And joining us, as he has on other occasions before, David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR News and the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks so much, Colin. Great to join you.
So David, let's start with yesterday, for example, the New York Times hit various people's driveways. And the lead story is basically about how Donald Trump really almost can't win a general election. And it's all based on polling. It's all based on polling of the general election, which is kind of way out there. It's full of caveats. It's Nate Cohn and somebody else writing it. And they have the appropriate caveats in there that there are ways in which these polls are not necessarily entirely reliable. They're trying to pull head-to-head on candidates who haven't campaigned against one another. But it's also the lead story in the Times. And the Times doesn't run a lot of lead stories that are based on information that is, fungible, I guess. So, I mean, is there a problem with
the term of art these days is analytic.
Analytic.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. So what about that? I mean, they're putting a lot of weight on something that in just a second, Jennifer will tell us how much weight they should actually put.
Well, we can yield to Jennifer laying down some real knowledge in a moment. Yeah. But let me offer you a couple of thoughts along the way before we get there. The first thing is that, the Sunday front page of the New York Times is more of a magazine and more of a kind of general overview publication than a news that just happened. Mm-hmm. The daily newspaper is kind of something of a magazine these days, too. The news cycle is so compressed and so quick that they really want to be giving you more of an overview or enterprise reporting, something that's not off something just over the wire in the last few minutes, because they know that news is now often perishable. And so they want to provide something extra. I think that we would be a little upset if the New York Times, in its wisdom, in its newsroom, in Nate Cohn works for The Upshot, which is this very analytics-driven division of the newsroom and reporting on politics and economics and social science and the like, if they had some knowledge and came to a conclusion and decided to withhold that from the public, if they said, we are basing our reporting on the conclusion that Trump is, certainly quite likely to win, but not certain to win the nomination of one of the two major parties, and stands a chance of going down into one of the worst defeats in American political history. But we're not going to share that with you, dear reader, because we think that you are too sensitive and too confused a person to be able to process that. But we'd say, well, what the heck is that? These elites over on, West 41st Street deciding for us what we should or shouldn't know. Share us with us. Gosh darn it. Give us our information. So there's that. I also think that if you think back to classic political reporting of the second half of the last century, it was defined in some ways by the approach of David Broder, who started out as a young reporter, at small papers in Illinois, rose to the New York Times, and then became the dean of the Washington Press Corps at the Washington Post. And what he did was he used, what he called shoe leather. He would wear out his shoes during the campaigns, knocking on doors and asking questions. And in a sense, on a much smaller scale, what he was doing is what pollsters at their best are attempting to achieve, which is he's trying to get a feel for the electorate, its mood, its concerns, its issues, not what politicians tell you is important to the voter, but what voters might actually tell you if you encounter them themselves. So, good news organizations are supplementing interviews on the ground with voters that are not in any way solicited by political figures or entities, maybe doing focus groups to figure out what themes matter, doing polling, and doing their own reporting. And the problem to me is more a question of whether, you know, particularly on online sites and cable news, where the demand for new content is almost incessant, that you're just providing one poll after another, and there's just this kind of jawing about the latest poll, and we can talk about the polls themselves a bit journalistically, but just incessant focus on that as though that replaces the issues that the politicians are arguing over, the strategies, the dynamics involved. It's that it's simply about the polls in and of itself, I think, displaces so much else that's going on in the election. That, to me, is what's distortive.
All right. So you've opened several boxes that I want to try to remember to come back to, but as we're doing this. So, Jennifer Dineen, let's go back to something that you said the last time you were here, then Ann Seltzer said today, that a poll is a snapshot of a moment, right? It's sort of how things look right now.
Exactly.
And so right now, two candidates have not run head-to-head in a general election. Let's assume, for the purposes of discussion, that it's Trump versus Clinton. They haven't run against each other. They haven't spent as much time saying really horrible things about each other as they're going to say. They haven't done all of the things that basically happen in a general election. So while people are running the hurdles, we're talking about the high jump, and I'm wondering whether that makes sense or how much we can rely on a poll about the high jump while people are still running the hurdles.
I mean, it doesn't make sense, I don't think, and we can only rely on it to describe now. I mean, where we get into trouble is when people do polls now and we rely on them to predict what will happen a year from now or, you know, 10 months from now or however. So, I mean, yeah, that's the problem. It's a snapshot. It's telling you what things look like now. And the fact is those two candidates aren't running against each other now and people aren't making a decision. I mean, we say often that the electorate for the general election does not really start to grapple with firm candidate choice until the baseball playoffs. And so you're always going to have those voters who are strong partisans and firmly grounded on a particular end of the ideological spectrum and pick a candidate early on. But for most voters, that is not primary in their decision making. There's lots of things that are going to happen between now and then. Breakfast tomorrow, for example, right? That are more in the forefront of their mind. So they're giving you a sense of where they are now, but that's not predictive. And it's not fair to expect it to be.
Now, David, one of the good things that has happened, I think it's a good thing anyway, is that there's been the rise of a new kind of journalist, too, that most newspapers and big news organizations have, you know, quants or semi-quants working for them, people who really kind of specialize in looking at poll data, evaluating poll data, telling you stuff about the guts or at least what they think are the guts of poll data. That, I mean, I guess that's really useful for the quote unquote high information voter anyway.
You know, it's almost like a third level, though. You have political reporters, then you have reporters who are well-versed enough in how statistics work to be able to talk about the polls, and then the quants, as you call them, you know, which is kind of pulled from the way in which they would hire young students from physics and higher-level math to go into financial institutions, right? Well, these similar kinds of minds are at work thinking about breaking down numbers and looking at trends and then cross-tabulating. To me, you know, polls are and analytics, for that matter, are a complement to other kinds of reporting. They shouldn't be replacing and displacing it. And I think that's so important. One of the most frustrating things to me is not only are individual pollsters doing more polls than they might once have done, whether they're professionals, whether they're out of universities, what have you, whatever their motivations, but also that news organizations are reporting about movements in the polls as though there's a correlation between the methodologies and approaches those polls took. And it may well be that, you know, your guests have previously dissected this a bit. But I think journalistically there's a real problem. You say, well, the Marist poll shows this. The Washington Post poll shows that. You know, it shows a rise for Cruz. Well, those may have been engineered in very different ways. And so those kinds of comparisons, I think, are pretty invidious. But I think that, you know, the kinds of quants you're talking about, people who are very well versed in this are smart enough to be able to cut through that and look at maybe some underlying trends or concerns that can be elicited and extracted from these surveys. But I think a lot of times people are just talking about this because it's exciting. It's as though you're announcing the Kentucky Derby or something and the horses are gaining when, you know, sometimes it's happening and sometimes it's not. I just think journalistically we hand over a lot of our discretion when we get these polls over, you know, online or in our email boxes. And it really, because it suggests there's some change in dynamics, it says to us, well, there's change that's new, that by definition is news, and we should be talking about that rather than all kinds of other things we could be looking at.
You know, Jennifer Dineen, one thing that I, as a journalist, try on my more conscientious days, which maybe don't dominate my life, but when I'm having one of the things that I ask myself is, what does a political professional want to know about this poll or the internal poll that the political professional, the campaign manager or someone else in the campaign, what do they want to know? And I always assume, and it's based on some conversations with them too, that it's not necessarily the horse race numbers that David's talking about. It's the underlying stuff that David wants people to think about. Well, I'll tell you who's thinking about them, the campaign. They're saying, wow, do we have a problem here with guns or immigration, or in other words, is our message not getting across right, or can we hurt the other person because the other person has a problem here on this particular issue? That in a way, some of that crosstab information that is available a lot of the times in public polls but is less likely to be reported than the horse race is exactly the stuff the insiders want to look at, and probably in the ways that David is suggesting is arguably more important.
I think that provides more insight and information into the dynamics of the race, which voters are still in play, what issues are important to them, how are certain positions resonating or causing people to defect. I think those are important and insightful questions, and the poll information can provide that insight and add color more to a journalist reporting rather than being the story in and of itself. I think the other thing David alludes to is there are so many different methods and pollsters now, and that we're comparing them all together. So we're comparing Marist to public policy polling, to Rasmussen, and that we don't have enough information about how the different methodologies produce a different picture of the electorate, but we know that they do. Mm-hmm. Right, we know that IVR polls have fewer undecided voters, and mm-hmm. That stronger partisans tend to be the ones willing to engage. The problem is that even as we've gone back and looked at, let's say, all of the polls done in campaigns since 2008, the last month of the election, so the polls that are closest to being able to actually be predictors, the effect that method has isn't consistent, and that's some of what we lose when we have people who aren't quants or the experts in polling looking at this. That stuff is hard to tease out.
And David, the press is full of human beings too, and although that's arguable, that's debatable, but let's just say the press is full of human beings. And so,
many of us.
Yeah. So knowing people who were not in the media but who were very politically invested, say, 4 years ago, among the people who were really interested and thought that Nate Silver was a genius in September of that election year were people who wanted a certain outcome. Oh, well, you know, Nate Silver, he's brilliant. Look what he says. He says the thing that I want to have happen is going to happen. And I'm wondering about the press, too, whether maybe we cherry pick a little bit, or maybe we get really interested in polling results that at least fits some kind of scenario that we've cooked up on our own for whatever reason.
Well, I may get the precise figures wrong, but my recollection was that Nate Silver's 538 blog at the New York Times generated something like 50% of its political traffic during the home stretch of the presidential election. It's just one sense of people obsessively checking, was Obama going to win? Was he not going to win? Mm-hmm. The sense was that this was not simply all over the political spectrum, but that actually that you know, people who wanted reassurance that a Democrat would remain in the White House turned to Silver's blog. He is at once somebody who I think is pretty intellectually honest about how he comes by his conclusions in aggregating the results of many polls, but also is sympathetic to Obama, so, you know, publicly, so that it perhaps provides some solace. I think perhaps the most vivid example of what you're talking about is the 2012 fall campaign, where there was a sense where I don't think it was true at the top levels of the Romney campaign. Certainly Stuart Stevens, his chief campaign strategist, has said, you know, that they were always clear that they were underwater to Obama fundamentally. But that in a much of the Republican elites and the Republican establishment, that people had convinced themselves that Romney would win and that Obama simply could not be reelected, that this guy wasn't a true president. You know, there'd been a significant core of the Republican Party that bought into the birther argument, that there was just, or that it was at least an open question as to whether President Obama was born here, where in fact there was no doubt about it whatsoever. And there was just this tangible belief that he could not be reelected. Well, Fox News ran polls. And as your panelists, I'm sure, could tell you, they were pretty good polls that the Fox News did. They were professional. They came out. They showed reasonable leads for Obama. And they I think, more, by and large, held up over time. Well, Fox News reported its own polls, the ones it had commissioned from its own people, but it sure buried them. And it spent a lot of time on other polls showing desperate rays of hope for Republicans any chance it could. And I thought that the gap between the amount of time Fox News spent on Fox's polls and the amount of time that its, particularly its lead personality, spent on polls seemingly showing Republican advances that were not borne out by the vote was a pretty striking one indeed.
Who are you going to believe, me or your own lying pollsters? They don't even believe their own pollsters. All right. So we have to take a little break here. We'll come back. We'll have more from Jennifer and David. And so stay with us.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill and Ray Hardman appeared in the intro, and Greg tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Alexandra Ingber and Tiana Duquette. The part of Bill Curry was played by Stanley Greenberg. For show pages, articles, and to fill out a poll about the staff of Here and Now, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, is golf a dying civilization? And now, back to Colin.
In a way, that's sort of a two-part question. But anyway, Jennifer Dineen with us, program director of the Graduate Program in Survey Research at UConn Department of Public Policy. David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR News and the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. So we have a limited amount of time and a bunch of stuff that I want to cover. So I'll start with you, David, for just a second. I mean, to go back to the Fox News example, one reason that a not-so-fair and balanced media organization might have to want to downplay negative information about a certain candidate's chances, even coming from its own research department, its own polls, is what we might think of as almost a reverse bandwagon effect, right? If you run, I mean, this is a fear that the Bernie Sanders supporters have right now in their narratives, that if you run a lot of stories about how polls say that so-and-so has no chance, it starts to be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Oh, I think that's very much right. You had Dick Morris, the discredited former Clinton public opinion strategist, who also worked for a lot of Republicans over the years. And he had been among the people saying there's no doubt but that it's going to be a slam dunk for Romney on Fox, talking again and again. And then afterwards he said, well, I felt that I needed to give conservatives a flag to rally around, and I needed to tell people what they needed to hear to keep up their morale and, you know, retain any hope, however faint, that Romney might actually pull this thing off. He was then sort of shuttled into a small windowless room for some time by Fox and had not been seen again on the network. But, you know, he acknowledged the secret that had been driving so many statements from folks on Fox who were presented as experts and thoughtful analysts as opposed for the ideological cheerleaders that they turned out to be.
So, Jennifer Dineen, how real is that concept of the bandwagon effect?
Well, the bandwagon effect is a real thing. I mean, it's certainly not just in politics, but in sports and all sorts of things, right? There's reasons people like to cheer for a winner, and people sometimes look to others, to their peers, for a decision if they're having a hard time making it. But what we know from some of the research we've done in this area is that the bandwagon effect doesn't matter the same all the time, and it doesn't matter the same for everybody. So if you look at different types of issues, different policy issues, for example, where the bandwagon effect matters more is where the policy issue cuts across parties, and so the parties don't have as strong a position on them, right? Mm. So people are looking for cues, and so they're likely to jump on board. On issues or with candidates where there is a strong unity in terms of a partisan preference, the bandwagon effect matters less because we also know that people are more receptive to information that makes sense with their belief system, right? So for those voters in the middle, for undecided voters, for weak partisans, the bandwagon effect can play a larger role than it does for the party's core.
And when you say play a larger role, does it play a larger role the way I described? I mean, in other words, so-and-so has no chance, so then people don't vote for that person?
Well, when I say a larger role, I mean in the ability to move somebody's opinion,
yeah.
right? If we did an experiment and you gave people the same information, mm-hmm. the people in the policy areas or with the candidates that don't fit strongly in the party framework,
mm-hmm.
those and people who are sort of in the middle, they're more likely to have their opinion changed by the information. But you're right. I mean, polls, but also partisan media play an effect in candidates' ability to raise money, to get invited to appearances and events. And so the bandwagon effect plays out in politics, but polls aren't the only contributor there.
So I'm going to ask each of you the same question, but you'll come at it from different angles. David Folkenflik, how do you make decisions about which polls to pay attention to?
I tend to go to aggregators and look at the spreads and compare them against one another and look and see if there is a sort of uniform movement in one direction toward Ted Cruz, away from Donald Trump, or, you know, just one example of many in a given state. And I really do tend to look state by state rather than nationally. Because it's these campaigns are not really fought nationally. Mm-hmm. It really is because of the electoral system, and because I'm interested in movement that gives you some sense of where people are headed. And if it's shown consistently in 6-7 polls, you know, that are pretty reputable, then you say they're probably onto something. Unless they've all made just deep, glaring miscalculations in, you know, who the likely voters are going to be. But I'm actually more interested in what Jennifer says.
All right, Jennifer. I mean, people have
feeling
a limited amount
pressure.
Of time to figure this
sure.
thing out, you know?
So, I mean, there are some basic questions. I mean, I think David's point, not so much of using a particular aggregator's average, but looking at the polls as a collection is helpful. But I always look at who did the poll, who was the sponsor, do they have a tie to a candidate or a particular interest group or a cause, or are they an independent organization? Is the sample appropriate for the question? So when we are looking, you know, 2 days before Election Day or a week, 2 weeks before Election Day, are we looking at likely voters?
Mm-hmm.
Are we looking at registered voters? Are we looking at general pop? Does that make sense?
So Jennifer, if I can jump
yeah.
in, though,
sure.
for the average listener who's, you know, smart and interested and engaged, you're asking a lot for them to look at each of those factors for each of these polls, right? So how do you suggest to them a way? Like, I look at Real Clear Politics, or I'll look at, you know, the pollster at the Huffington Post, or I might look at 538.
Sure.
Some place where I trust them to try to winnow out some of the
well,
lesser
and they
polls.
Do.
But what would you suggest?
Well, and those sites do give you indicators of those things. I mean, a lot of it is, you're right, there's a lot. I mean, I have a list of 6 things. Some people have a list of 20 things. But this points to 2 things. One, the challenge of the poll disseminator. So not just the polling organizations, but how these polls are covered and the need for knowledgeable journalists and analysts to be able to convey this information quickly and point these things out to people. I think that, you know, we have a lot of new space to fill, but the amount of space that we get to talk about how these are done and which polls are done of more quality and how the differences between the polls, that space seems to be shrinking and shrinking.
In fact, it's shrinking right now. It's shrinking down to 0. It just actually have a whole bunch of other things I wanted to ask about. So we'll have to do this again another time, sooner rather than later. Thank you so much to David Folkenflik from NPR News and to Jennifer Dineen from the UConn Department of Public Policy, and also to Ann Seltzer from Seltzer & Company. Thanks especially to Betsy Kaplan, who figured this whole thing out.
Okay, great. How many countries have you visited?
4.
And do you love me anymore?
I...
Did you ever really love me in the first place?
Alexa, I'm not doing this.
Okay, George W. Bush, great president or greatest president?